I'm Afshin Ratansi, and you're watching Going Underground, globally broadcast, except in the US and Europe. Banned on YouTube, but available on Odyssey and on RT.com and live on Rumble.com. Coming up in the show, will the US and EU's insistence on Ukraine's option to join NATO lead to global economic catastrophe? And who benefits financially from the death and destruction as Russia advances into Ukraine while tens of millions face hunger in Afghanistan, Yemen and Somalia, according to NGOs? And 2 years since the U.S. publicly released Pentagon wargaming of what they called a limited nuclear war with Russia, what would happen if just one nuclear weapon fell on London, New York or Moscow? We find out from the two-time Nobel Prize-winning Nuclear Weapons Abolition Committee. All this and more coming up in today's Going Underground. But first, today, Russia is scheduled to make its next key interest payment, despite now being the world's most sanctioned country. This is governments and economists around the world warn the war in Ukraine is causing catastrophic economic consequences. Joining me now from California is Professor of Economics Jack Rasmus of California St. Mary's College and host of the weekly radio show Alternative Visions. Thank you so much, Professor Rasmus, for coming on. Obviously, a terrible tragedy, the pictures of children dead, wounded, upset, grieving. But at the same time, no word from the US or NATO and arguable client states that the war in Ukraine may actually have economic benefits. Despite the denials, what evidence is there that Washington wanted a confrontation and could economically benefit from this war?
Yes, well, you know, who are the big benefiters? Just watch what's happening to their bottom line here. Of course, the U.S. oil companies, big time benefiting from this record price surge going on.
Although it went down a little in the past week as the war progressed.
Yeah, because there's a growing concern that it may slow the economy. And there are signs that that's what's going to happen. We're going to get the GDP figures for the U.S. here very soon. It's going to show first quarter very little growth. And that was really before all the war and the inflation. Inflation, cuts consumer spending big time as we shift our consumption to pay for the oil companies and the natural gas companies and all the other commodities. And what you got are monopolistic companies, the big companies who have been hiding behind the supply chain issue, many of them without a supply problem. A good example are meat cutting companies in the U.S. Raising meat prices 25%. They don't have a supply problem, but they've been hiding behind it. And now, of course, we've got inflationary expectations on top of inflation. We got the same thing going on. If you look at inflation, there's a little bit of a demand problem last summer as the economy opened. A big contribution to inflation due to global supply chains, as we know. But also domestic supply problems in the U.S. were also a major contributor. But the big contributor, I think, is just price gouging by these big monopolistic corporations going on in the U.S. who don't have a supply problem and are hiding behind the supply issue to just simply price gouge going on.
They would say it's because of the increased price of futures contracts on energy supplies because of the war.
Yes, well, I mean, who are the persons driving up futures contracts? They're the global oil speculators buying the contracts and causing the prices to go up, holding the supply off the market. Is that a supply problem or is that a problem of just speculation and greed? I think it's both going on here.
Well, the UK Prime Minister's in Saudi Arabia shortly after the mass execution of 81 people, of course, controversially, and that's all about oil, supposedly. What do you think about, obviously weapons company stocks have done well. Germany going to the old, 1930s Nazi Germany levels in terms of weapons spending, arguably. At the end of Nord Stream 2, though, while it is mourned in Berlin, you think that may be all according to plan, according to Washington hegemonic interests?
Oh, yeah. I think, this thing is not by accident that the U.S. Has been hiding behind NATO here to squeeze Russia out of Europe. it's not just Nord Stream. The U.S. wants Russia economically out of Western Europe and replace it. You know, the U.S. goods would replace it. Natural gas is one, just one example. But I think it's broader than just that. The war was a good excuse for the U.S. to reestablish its hegemony over NATO, which was really shaken during the Trump years. So those are two major geopolitical objectives: drive Russia out of the European economy, Western European economy, reestablish hegemony over NATO, restore the add to the defense industry, military industrial defense industry contracts, which is going to be at least $50 billion this year, I think, added to a $778 billion budget already. The oil companies and other companies that have that took a hit during the COVID recession, you know, now are able to recoup and more than recoup their lost profits. So there's a lot to be gained by the U.S. In this whole situation if it manages it correctly, which it thinks it will. You know, they played. I believe that. The U.S. played the Ukrainians like a violin here to get them to engage in recent years over a deeper military and economic relations with the United States and to get them to declare they wanted to join NATO to taunt Russia and really to provoke it. I believe that's what's going on. It's a big geopolitical game going on here. It's not by accident what's happening. And a lot of Western interests, particularly economic, have an awful lot to gain.
Well, there's bipartisan support, arguably, for the $778 billion to be increased. And as you know, Washington, Strasbourg, Brussels, NATO headquarters all saying this is nothing to do with what you just said. It's all to do with the unprovoked attack by Russia, and the war began just 21 days ago, not 8 years ago or even before. You mentioned the effect of inflationary pressure in the United States. What about on the global south, on civil society in Europe? Should we expect global unrest against, well, ironically, against some arguable client states of Washington, D.C. in the global south, in Africa and Asia and Latin America?
Oh, yes. Well, you know, a lot of the inflation is global because we're dealing with global commodities here, not just oil, but industrial commodities and agricultural commodities. And that's translating now into inflation. And, of course, the more inflation you get, the more unstable business investment is. Businesses pull back. And, of course, the consumer. So I believe this is going to result in another recession, global recession here, not immediately, but certainly by 2023. Whenever we've had this kind of a commodities oil inflation surge, it's always resulted in a recession. And the U.S. economy was already weak going into this thing. So it's almost inevitable, I think, the response will be a real economic contraction in the wake of this super inflation going on.
What does it actually mean when the U.S. sanctions Russia on all these metals and commodities that we find in our mobile phones, in the cell phones and computers? Will they just go through to China and then China will produce them under their own brands if a brand like Apple is forced by the U.S. government, or they actually arguably virtue signal and say they care about the dying children of Ukraine, therefore they cannot operate in Russia? Will there just be new pathways and we'll be buying phones with different brands on them, or...?
Yeah, to some extent, depends on the product itself. Consumer phones, for example, yes, China can certainly produce those. So you'll have a redirection of global trade and global production. We're finding a new bifurcation of the global economy that's going on. And interestingly, even Saudi Arabia just announced it's going to trade oil with China using the yuan, right? Using the yuan. What that means is they're trying to protect their contracts with China, because now you're going to see a major flow of oil going east from Russia. Eventually, of course, they're just
not that widely reported there, that story. I wonder why. I'm not sure. The spring planting season, of course, wheat, the biggest producer in Western Europe, Ukraine. What effect is it going to have on wheat, quite apart from the nickel trading closed down on the London Metal Exchange this week?
Yeah, it's going to have some effect, on prices. And you got to understand, a lot of these sanctions haven't even been implemented yet. It's just the fact that they are coming has led to a response by companies to raise their prices. So they're not even in effect. A good example is the oil sanctions on Russian oil are not even in effect. They've been announced, right? And then, of course, the sanctions don't include Gazprom Bank, right? The biggest bank in Russia, which is free to continue to deal with trading in gas and oil. So it's corporations taking advantage of the situation to raise prices, I think.
European countries say they're weaning themselves off that. But I mean, is there a point you can say?
Yeah, weaning yourself off, natural gas. The Europeans don't have the port facilities to handle U.S. liquid natural gas.
They say they're going to build them. Is there a point?
5 years.
Is there a point in that some people said if Putin wanted to avenge the 14,000 killed since 2014 in the coup, he could have just switched off the gas off Western Europe. Would that actually have killed more than the killing that we're watching on our TV screens coming from Ukraine in terms of hypothermia and so on in Western Europe?
Well, we certainly know when there are extreme cold or heat spells that people die. So it's kind of hard to estimate that. But, it's kind of doubled back on the sanctioners because the price of oil and commodities have risen. And so what Russia may have lost in terms of volume of sales is made up in price. So I don't think the oil sanctions have really had that much effect. And, of course, just the U.S. that imports very little Russian oil. Europe will never implement sanctions on Russian oil and gas. They're talking about years to come to prepare for it. That might happen, but you're not going to see that much actually implemented, I don't think. But that won't stop companies from raising their prices behind the cover of the supply shortage. And then, of course, they can go and try to get natural gas from Qatar and places like that. But it's going to take at least a couple of years to expand their production facility to provide Europe with natural gas.
Well, so, all those big multinationals, as you know, they all say they operate in a competitive framework and certainly never, ever price gouge. Professor Jack Rasmus, thank you.
My pleasure.
After the break. After bio-warfare claims and counterclaims in NATO-armed Ukraine, what now is the danger of global nuclear war or even so-called limited nuclear war? And how long will the climate catastrophe of a nuclear winter last? All this and more coming up in part two of Going Underground. Welcome back. As NATO pours arms to defend President Zelensky in Ukraine and launches an all-out economic war on Russia, it is 2 years since the U.S. published Pentagon planning for what they called was a limited nuclear war against Russia. After reports that Russian forces struck a Ukrainian military base kilometers away from the border of NATO member Poland, what would a nuclear war look like? I'm joined now from Northampton in Massachusetts by the co-founder and immediate past president of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War and recipient of two Nobel Peace Prizes, Dr. Ira Helfand. Thank you so much, Dr. Helfand, for coming on. So Zelensky on the record for questioning Ukraine's giving up of nuclear weapons as part of a deal that created the modern Ukraine, as it were. Russia now on high alert, it says. Responding to what they said as NATO powers. How dangerous a moment is it right now for the possibility of nuclear war?
I think it's an extremely dangerous moment, probably the most dangerous moment since the Cuban Missile Crisis, possibly the summer of 1983. Putin's invasion of Ukraine and the horrible humanitarian catastrophe which it has caused has really brought us to the brink of nuclear war again, something which we thought we would not face again in our lifetime.
But of course, as I just said there, around 2 years ago, the Pentagon was already wargaming for limited nuclear war. Just describe what you understand by the term limited nuclear war, what that means or may mean, and whether this may indeed be informing geostrategists in NATO about the current conflict.
Well, if we're talking about war between Russia and NATO, the concept of limited nuclear war, I think, is an oxymoron. The war games that I've seen have all indicated that if nuclear weapons are used at all between NATO and Russia, it will rapidly escalate to something which could no longer be called a limited nuclear war. And unfortunately, with the repeated nuclear threats that Putin has made, there is a real possibility that this situation in Ukraine, this terrible humanitarian catastrophe, will escalate further into the use of nuclear weapons, which would be completely catastrophic for both sides.
Putin, of course, says, oh, it's the West that is talking about nuclear weapons. And the West says vice versa, as so many other elements of this current conflict. But, you know, it was only on January the 3rd this year that the US, UK, Russia, China, France issued a statement, a nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought. And they said that the existence, as they said for so long, and I know your organization has always doubted it, that it's nuclear weapons that prevents war.
Well, clearly, the current situation has proven that nuclear weapons do not prevent war. Nuclear weapons did not deter Russia from invading Ukraine and creating this extraordinarily dangerous situation, which may well escalate to the actual use of nuclear weapons. The statement in the beginning of January was somewhat hopeful, but statements are not what count. Actions are what count, and the nuclear-armed states need to actually eliminate their nuclear arsenals in compliance with their obligations, both under the Non-Proliferation Treaty and also so that they will be eligible to join the new treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons.
Well, Russia is very keen to downplay this nuclear element after it initially said, look, they're now on high alert. And American politicians, they waver between on the one hand saying, no, this won't be escalate that way. And then we heard Nancy Pelosi mentioning it the other day. We had National Security Advisor, former National Security Advisor John Bolton on the program. And the new National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, associated with the Libya catastrophe, said full force will be applied, even for an accidental hit on a NATO country. He's surely not, by expressing it that way, full force, even countenancing nuclear weapons. Is he or isn't he?
I have no idea. I think that the nuclear threats in this situation have been quite explicit on the Russian side. The United States has been clear that it will defend NATO territory if the war spills over to NATO. And I think that this situation has been created where escalation to nuclear war is very possible. And we need to consider what that would involve, because it would not be a limited situation. A nuclear war between NATO and Russia would be the end of civilization as we know it, and the deaths of hundreds of millions of people promptly. Even a single 100 kiloton bomb, the size of the weapons carried on Russian submarines, that detonated over, say, London, would kill 250,000 people and injure 900,000 people, completely overwhelming the ability of the medical establishment in London to deal with that crisis. Similar bomb detonated over Moscow would kill also 250,000 people and injure more than 1 million people because of the greater population density. But it's unlikely that it would be a single nuclear weapon over a single city. If one nuclear weapon flies in this situation, we're probably going to have a large-scale nuclear war, and there'll be many weapons targeted on many cities. A study that we did back in 2003 showed that if just 300 of the 1,500 warheads in the strategic Russian arsenal detonated over cities in the United States, 75 to 100 million people would die in the first afternoon. The entire economic infrastructure of the country would be destroyed. Everything that we need to maintain our lives, there'd be no electric grid, no internet, no food distribution system, no system for distributing heating oil or water. In the months following that initial attack, the rest of the population would almost certainly die. And if the United States attacked Russia, the exact same thing would happen in Russia. But that's only the direct effects. We have to consider also the climate disruption that would follow from such a nuclear war. The studies have shown that 150 million tons of soot would be boosted into the upper atmosphere, blocking out the sun, dropping temperatures across the planet, and creating conditions which have not existed since the last ice age. In the interior regions of North America and Eurasia, temperatures would drop 45 to 50 degrees Fahrenheit. Under these conditions, all of the ecosystems which have evolved since the last ice age would collapse. Food production would stop, and the vast majority of the human race would starve. Now, this is the situation which the threat we have lived with every day of the nuclear age, because as long as these weapons exist, there is always the possibility they will be used. And it is a danger which has been disastrously exacerbated by Putin's invasion of Ukraine, which has brought us to the brink of this kind of catastrophe. If we are lucky enough to survive the coming weeks without nuclear annihilation, we have to understand that we are living through a worldwide near-death experience, and we have to act accordingly. My organization, the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, is calling on NATO and Russia to make an unequivocal statement at this time that they will not, under any circumstances, use nuclear weapons in the context of this war in Ukraine.
Before you got to the nuclear winter part, arguably for many Global South countries, they've been living with, say, a 100 kiloton weapons effects already, arguably 377,000 killed in Yemen, after all, according to the UN figures with UK, US, EU armed bombing. And you must have heard this, that the analysts in NATO countries are fond of claiming that those who say the things like you've just said are, in fact, doing Putin's job for him and somehow helping Russian talking points when what is needed now is the pouring of EU weapons into Ukraine to fight off the Russians. And what you're saying is somehow defeatist and plays into Putin's hands.
I don't think it's defeatist. I think it's stating the reality. And it's not directed at NATO or at Russia. It's directed at both of them. Both sides in this potential conflict have to explicitly state they will not use nuclear weapons. Putin needs to stop his war on Ukraine. He needs to declare a ceasefire and withdraw his troops. But we're talking about a slightly separate issue, which is the potential destruction of the entire planet as a result of this war that Putin has launched. And all sides have to behave responsibly in this situation. They all have to promise that they will not use nuclear weapons, and they need to take, as soon as this conflict can be resolved, they need to take the next step and sit down, face the fact that they have brought the world to the brink of extinction, acknowledge that nuclear weapons do not make us safe, but are the greatest source of our insecurity, and begin the serious negotiation to eliminate their nuclear arsenals in a verified, enforced, time-bound manner, so that we can rid this planet of this danger once and for all and never again be in this situation.
Well, Britain is clear. It wants to advance its Trident program in Scotland.
All of the nuclear armed states are currently engaged in augmenting their nuclear capabilities.
Yeah, I've just got to ask you, your organization won two Nobel Prizes, Peace Prizes, 2017, 1985. What do you think is going through their heads then when it comes to the building of tactical nuclear weapons, as they're called, by Russia? Russia has a lot of them. And as I was saying earlier, this W-76-2 low-yield submarine-launched missile, again, these are different to the Cuban Missile Crisis. These are countenance nuclear war weaponry.
I think there's a dangerous solution on the part of the military establishment in all of the nuclear armed countries that they can use nuclear weapons and not trigger a worldwide nuclear conflict. So these tactical nuclear weapons are extremely dangerous because they do lower the threshold for use of nuclear weapons. And once we cross that threshold, we have no idea what is on the other side. But the war games that I'm aware of that have been done suggests that whenever a nuclear weapon has been used in a war game situation, the conflict has always escalated to all-out nuclear war. Because the same reason that people didn't know how to avoid using a nuclear weapon in the first place, once nuclear weapons have been introduced into the picture, they do not know how to stop that process from escalating further.
People can watch our interview with Stanley Kubrick's daughter, the daughter of the famous director of Dr. Strangelove, which there are intimations of what you're saying in that film. Just finally, biowarfare claims and counterclaims about U.S. labs there. claims and counterclaims about false flags over attacking nuclear reactors, the nuclear reactor at Chernobyl. How dangerous is that? Is that more likely, arguably, than what will happen with nuclear mass killing and a climate catastrophe, nuclear winter?
The situation around the nuclear power plants in Ukraine is extremely dangerous. These facilities were not designed to function in a war zone. And they're yet one more aspect of the extremely reckless nature of this invasion of Ukraine, putting all of these nuclear facilities at risk of meltdown. And we don't know what's going to happen to them. There are many different ways that a disaster could unfold at a nuclear power plant. And there are, my understanding is, 15 nuclear reactors active in Ukraine. There are also nuclear reactors in Russia and other countries around Ukraine, which potentially could be affected if there was a widespread loss of electricity due to damage to the electric grid. This is an extremely dangerous situation as well, although I don't think it is as dangerous, frankly, as the concern that I've just expressed about this escalating to nuclear war, which would be a catastrophe for the entire planet.
Dr. Ira Helfand, thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for the show. We'll be back on Saturday, 19 years to the eve of the arguably illegal invasion of Iraq by the United States, the United Kingdom, Australia, and Poland. Tens of millions were killed, wounded, or displaced. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's available in your country, and let us know what you will do if the war in Europe turns nuclear. And remember, regardless of NATO nation censorship, Going Underground is available to watch on Odyssey and at rt.com.